Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Special Report. Former President Donald Trump, who received the GOP presidential nomination at the top of today's Republican National Convention, makes his first public appearance since Saturday's assassination attempt. The crowd at the RNC cheered and then raised fists, chanting fight, as Trump, with a bandage over a portion of his right ear, sits next to his family and the freshman U.S. senator he has chosen as his running mate, J.D. Vance. Earlier, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia told attendees that she thanks God that his hand was on President Trump. Meantime, President Biden, in an interview with NBC News, says,
"I'm not the guy that said I want to be a dictator on day one. I'm not the guy that refused to accept the outcome of the election. I'm not the guy who said that won't accept the outcome of this election automatically. You can't only love your country when you win."
CBS News Special Report, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
News, I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Former President Donald Trump is in Milwaukee for the Republican National Convention after being shot in the ear Saturday at a rally in Pennsylvania. Trump is still planning to deliver a speech at the RNC on Thursday night. However, he told the Washington Examiner that he has completely rewritten his speech after Saturday's events. The Secret Service said in a Sunday briefing that there will be no changes to security plans at the RNC. If you own a well on your property, the DNR says you should test your drinking water after all this rain and flooding. Flood water and runoff can introduce contaminants to a well that spread waterborne illnesses. Wells located in pits, basements, and low-lying areas are at a higher risk of contamination, according to a DNR press release. More information on testing and decontamination can be found on the Wisconsin DNR website. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
Hi, I'm Emily from Weikert Realtors Lake Point in Madison. Your home, your property, your decision. At Weikert Realtors Lake Point, we'll guide you every step of the way, whether you're buying or selling a home or exploring commercial property. Your dream is within reach. You'll find our realtors love what they do, and more importantly, we think it's fun helping our clients achieve their goals. Who wouldn't want to do that every day? Give me a call at 608-721-8002. Weikert Realtors Lake Point, 2045 Atwood Avenue. Find more info at weikert-lakepoint.com.
You're listening to The Shaw, W-A-U-K, Waukesha's home for Matt Nair on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Tragic weekend. Can put it no other way. The idea that political violence is okay, never. And I know I got a lot of response from people going, "Well, this is what we do, Rick. This is what Americans have done for generations." Still not acceptable on any level. Look, I am not a Trump supporter by any stretch of the imagination. I do believe he is dangerous for democracy. I do believe that his policies are dangerous for democracy. I believe his policies are bad for the working class. I think his policies are horrible for union members. I think his policies are bad for women, for minorities. Go down the list of all of the people except the very wealthy and the well-connected and the business interests. His policies are bad for the rest. And I believe that wholeheartedly, and which is why we talk about that. And on the policy level, where we should keep our fights and our arguments, he's the worst candidate in my view. That doesn't mean I want to see him harmed. And it's a disgrace that there were a couple of people out there saying, "Oh, it's a shame he missed." That's disgraceful and should never be tolerated. That said, this election is about the future of this country, the policies that each one of these people are going to move forward. And as you've heard me say a number of times, it's the teams that they bring in. It's the people that do the work of the administrative state. It's the people who do the work that affect our lives. That's your voting for too. And I've gone through, you know, the NLRB and the Department of Labor and the EPA and down the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission and all down the line and compared the Biden people and the Trump people. And time after time after time, in every instance, without exception, the people that Biden has chosen have come from the working class, have come from labor, have come from people fighting for the good of, well, the many. The folks that Donald Trump put into those positions, corporate special interest, union busters, all down the line. So when I came out against my union president, Sean O'Brien, going and speaking at the RNC, which I do not see as something that is positive, I've gotten a lot of blowback. Well, this is the kind of, you know, unity you're talking about. This is the kind of talking to the other side you're talking about. No, this is not what I'm talking about. The idea that Sean O'Brien is going to go there and give them tough talk, that's not going to happen. This speech is going to be well vetted, and anything he says will have been approved by a committee. So there's going to be no real tough talk. This idea that these are the conversations, no. The conversations that we need to be having are with each other. The people who are in those seats at that arena, the people who are waving the big Trump banner right now, those people are on board with the MAGA agenda. Pure and simple. They are on board with the MAGA agenda, which is, they've been very clear about returning this country to its origin, the original intent of the Constitution, which means, you know, Black folks, 3/5 of a person, women back in the kitchen, gays back in the closet, minorities back in the fields, and only white males, land-owning males, 21 and over, they're going to be the voters. That's the original intent. They're very clear about that. They've added Christian males, Christian white males, to that original intent. So they're willing to change it a little bit when it fits their need. But they're fundamentally talking about changing this country and doing it with this Project 2025. Project 2025 is dangerous to democracy. That does not mean in any way, shape, or form do I condone violence. I want to educate people. I want people to understand that this is not good for us. And that we go to the ballot box and we choose. Now, got a lot of press this weekend from a number of organizations talking about, you know, my union president going and speaking. And as I said to all of them, this is not personal with Sean O'Brien. This is not anything that makes me have any diminished thoughts of my union. In fact, this is what union democracy looks like. This is what I want for everybody. The ability to question leadership, the ability to talk, directly to power. I don't understand the end game here, because ultimately they are going to endorse Joe Biden because that's what the votes said that they have to do. So it's going to be an interesting moment where you have someone speaking before one convention and endorsing the other. And I doubt the DNC is going to allow O'Brien to speak, because I don't think it's ever been done where you've had a speaker at both conventions. I don't think you've had someone who says, I'm going to have a foot on each side of the fence. I don't think it's ever been done. So I would be surprised if the DNC, you know, gives him a platform. And for me, it's simple. A lot of my friends and a lot of people that I know who are Teamsters view him as endorsing Trump by whatever he says. Just the appearance of being here, and I've said that before. It's my hope that when the Teamsters do endorse, they do put their shoulder into their endorsed candidate, and we do get some push to ensure that, the candidate gets elected. Because for organized labor, be very concerned if Donald Trump is the president. Because we've already seen what he did. And from what I'm told, that ain't nothing to what he's going to do. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, is going to share some thoughts on the weekend's events. Maybe a little bit about the RNC. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, former Attorney General Billy Barr was quoted on Fox News saying, "The Democrats have to stop their grossly irresponsible talk about Trump being an existential threat to democracy. He is not," he says. And it's the Democrats' fault. It's the Democrats' fault for heated language. Never mind all of the videos we see of, you know, Republican candidates blowing things up and, you know, standing with guns around the Christmas tree and all of that. No. It's the Democrats' fault. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the events of the weekend and maybe where we're going to go from here. I've asked our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So what do you think of Billy Barr's comments?
Well, I think for a long time now, and I want to say this started, I don't know, maybe after I got out of office around 2006, I saw more of it, where something happens and they say, well, you know, if Obama had not said this, this person wouldn't have gotten shot, or, you know, if Trump had not said that, this wouldn't have happened. I mean, both sides have tended to do this a lot. And I knew this would be coming, that people would say on the Republican side that Biden made out such a threat by Trump that somebody was going to do something. You know, I don't like political heat arguments that cross lines. And, you know, of course, we have that all the time in today's world. But I think whether anything was ever said or not, somebody is going to do things like this because there are unbalanced people are out there that have weapons and they want to kill people. So now that this has happened, maybe both sides can tamper some, you know, some rhetoric down, both sides. Maybe Barr shouldn't even be saying, you know, what he's saying, but both sides need to, you know, get a little bit of calm out here. Now, as far as, you know, members saying, well, maybe they're under extra threat. I served 11 years. I was the one that oversaw the Capitol Hill Police as chairman of House Administration. I know, you know, the inside threat process for members of Congress. You know, I know, you know, what happened, what threats were out there and how we dealt with them. And maybe threats have increased, but I'll argue this, Rick, with the advent, because it wasn't there when I was there, the advent of Instagram, instant reporters, I call them, you know, TikTok, WhatsApp, everything that's around.
Yeah, all the social, you know, media.
That didn't exist to the extent it is now. That can ramp things up. You know, my own social media after this happened with the shooting of former President Trump, I mean, people were coming on where I'm like, okay, please, I don't want to see that. Let's not go there, you know?
It seems to me, and this is where maybe you'll agree, maybe you won't, you know, in the social media era, you know, on social media, people, they seem to think they have a license to be the worst version of themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And being the worst version of themselves, getting attention, which creates a self-fulfilling loop of people being horrible, saying horrible things, thinking horrible things, and then horrible things happening because of this loop. Or do you think I'm putting too much blame on social media? Because look, presidents have been shot in the past. Bad things have happened in the past. But I'm curious, your thought?
Oh, yes, bad things have happened. Presidents have been shot, people have been murdered, but social media can absolutely aggravate the entire system because, you know, a lot of people, they're tough on social media. While I'll get you, if they were face to face, they wouldn't be so tough.
Yeah.
But you know, when it comes to social media, you can be rude. You can do this. You can break up social media. You can get your divorce on social media. I mean, it's a whole different world. And I think this lends itself to real problems. So any member right now that, because Trump was shot, says, well, you know, it's really, really bad for me. Sure, there should be a look at security, but that's always been there.
Right.
People have always gotten mad at members of Congress and presidents. It happens. People get mad at neighbors and bad things happen. It happens in our country. Now, you know, in this case, again, because it's at the level and the press level where it's at, I think it's incumbent upon people within the political system to, you know, try to tamper this down a little bit in the rhetoric. And also, you know, let's be a bit proper about what's happened.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, though, that the rhetoric has gone towards Biden and not the shooter. Because what we know of the shooter, and I never say criminals' names on air, but the shooter was a registered Republican, had donated money years prior as a 17-year-old to an Act Blue account. It was like, I think, $15. Right. So there hasn't been the kind of, you know, attack in that way. So it seems like the attack necessarily went, you know, it's got to be Biden's fault because he said bullseye in a call not too long ago. So this has got to be what this person heard.
Again, you know, I don't know anything about him. We don't know anything about him yet. To what level he was unbalanced. Obviously, you know, he was after Trump. As we know, people go after presidents. President Biden's had threats, but you know, this thing started a few years back where this candidate said something bad happened and they blame it on the candidate.
Right.
This thing's been going back and forth like this for quite a while, for at least 10 or 12 years that, you know, that I've been doing work with the media. So, you know, I've viewed it, you viewed it. And I knew that eventually would happen. Of course, President Biden's coming out and he's going to have a investigation of this, selective investigation of it. Secret Service probably eventually is going to be slammed around, you know, for the person being on the roof.
Yep.
And nobody finding that out.
No, I believe that. But, you know, I want to go back to Congress because, you know, you as a former member, you know how this works. You know, if they're worried about their safety, if they're worried about, you know, things happening, shouldn't this be a moment for them to start tapping down the rhetoric? Shouldn't we be looking to our leaders? Look, I saw on Sunday night, President Biden came out and gave what I thought was a very good, you know, hey, you know, we've got to calm down. We've got to get back to the issues. You know, kind of a, you know, good, you know, grandfatherly kind of talk, you know, trying to calm the temperature down and refocus the campaigns. Isn't this what our leaders are supposed to do instead of throwing more incendiary, you know, slogans and anger out there? Shouldn't our leaders be the ones who are going, hey, we need to calm it down a bit?
Sure. And Biden did that. And he called Trump. And it was a quick but respectful, quote, phone call. And we haven't heard anything from Trump contrary to that. So, you know, Biden did the decent thing that he was to do. So far, Trump has done the decent thing of accepting that phone call to political rivals. And yes, if members of Congress are worried about threats, then, you know, go about your business, have your opinion, but also try to not, you know, get wild on the public stage right now. You know, you don't want copycat type of deals on this type of thing. But again, we don't know about the killer. We don't know what was in his mind. I'm sure they'll find out. And obviously, people that do these things are unbalanced for the most. I don't think they're patriots that think that, you know, they're actually doing something, or maybe they do. I don't know. But they've got to be unbalanced to do this type of thing.
I mean, to be honest, you know, all of that rhetoric, that again plays, I've always said, plays to the dim. This idea that the tree of liberty is watered with the blood of tyrants and patriots. A lot of people have that mindset that they're fighting for something, not quite sure what it is. And we hear a lot of rhetoric on both sides, but mostly on the Republican side, that we're going to take back our country and, you know, we're going to change it. Which is kind of weird. If you love the country, you know, why are you trying to change? Why are you trying to change it? Which is weird to me. But I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah. Look, you were around when, you know, my class shifted the Congress after 40 years to Republican control. Yeah. You were around that Contract with America, and everybody said, you know, what a bomb thrower Newt Gingrich was, and he and Clinton and the conflicts they had, you know, et cetera, which they did have some. But if you look back at that point in time, there were things that were said, for example, that we have a small window of opportunity to change, you know, the direction of the balanced budget in America, and, you know, to change how the government works, to make the Congress under its own laws that it makes. You know, there were statements made like that. But there weren't statements, to the best of my knowledge, and I could be wrong, that, you know, we're going to go, you know, take over the Capitol to do this. You know, we're going to have chaos in the hallways. I mean, that type of thing. Patriots rise up for the Contract with America. You know, that type of thing didn't exist. On the Democrat side, you didn't have it either. At least, maybe I'm getting old. Maybe my memory's getting bad on these things. I just think that as time went on, you know, things got way more intense. The verbiage got way more pinpointed and directed, and the social media just absolutely took rampant control of the political system, putting on there, you know, all kinds of things. You know, I saw, in fact, some of my relatives had sent me, this is after I was out of Congress, Rick, had sent me these lists of things that, did you know that members of Congress's kids' student loans are paid forever? Now, that might be minor, but they put things in there that when you read it, you're like, wow, you know, these members of Congress need to all resign and enforce. I mean, they were absolute lies.
Yeah.
And in the past, we didn't have a social network that could make these things go out to millions of people in a day. We just simply didn't have it.
No, we've gone from, you know, the email chains to now, right, all these memes that we see. But, you know, and you think back to, you know, you go back to Reagan ending the Fairness Doctrine, which had some parameters on what political speech was, and there had to be some balance that went with it. It wasn't perfect, but I'm curious if you think that had anything to do, and would it have mattered in the age of the internet if we had something like the Fairness Doctrine?
I don't know. The age of the internet, and I mean, I looked at the Fairness Doctrine, obviously it was around when, you know, I was there. The age of the internet kind of changes all of it. And I don't know how you monitor yet. If you monitor, you're taking away freedom, but can you allow for lies to be put out? And we've got a brand new AI on the horizon that's going to make our lives turn upside down politically. You can see that one coming. So I think social media just busts any particular law or rule that could be made these days.
Yeah.
It's a tough one. You know, the other aspect of this, assassination attempt on Trump, by the way, and I'm going to say this because I'm not going on either side of this in a bad way, but who are we to not fool ourselves that both sides, the political consultants, et cetera, they are analyzing, you know, after the shouting's done and the prayers are out there, and we, you know, try to unite the nation, but they're analyzing what this does, and it will make a change, Rick, in the beginning of the Republican convention tomorrow. It will make, you're going to see Trump in a unity fashion. You will see less, I bet you, you will see less verbiage in particular. You'll see it, but less verbiage about Biden. You're going to see this whole brand new unity thing because, you know, Biden's campaign too is analyzing how do you handle this?
Yeah.
You know, after it's all done, it's a factor in the election.
Well, I think that's been Biden's message all along. And, you know, uniting the country by,
right.
and look, you know, I think I've been saying for a long time, you do that through, through giving people opportunity. And I think the Biden record is very good on that. So I think he will be positioned well. And we'll see. You know, obviously this week is the RNC's, you know, spotlight in the sun. So you think it's going to be all about unity? What do you think comes out of this, though? I mean, I know you said the unity, but I guess where I'm putting my head around this is you've packed the place with the most vitriolic of speakers.
Right.
I can't imagine it's not going to be heavily. I just can't imagine that.
Well, I think don't get me wrong, they're going to go after Biden. But I think when it comes to Trump and his VP pick, which I think is going to be J.D. Vance, but when it comes to Trump and some of the higher echelon people, I think you're going to see a switch right now. Again, yes, Biden's going to be hit, but you're going to see a unity. And let me throw this out here. When it comes to Biden and Trump, Trump has lost some of his base. The people that really don't like him, the people that don't believe that he was targeted for criminal activity by the government, the people that believe, you know, that don't believe the election was stolen, et cetera, they've soured on Trump. Biden has his own detractors, the 18 to 34s, because of the Israel, you know, Gaza situation.
Right.
I think with Trump now, there may be very well people that, you know, they didn't like Trump, this and that, but, well, you know, now we've got this new unity, maybe they will now go to the polls and give him a vote. I mean, I'm stretching it, but I think, yes, Biden will be attacked, but I think you're going to hear this call for we need to come together. I think it's going to happen.
I'm looking for victimization, that he's going to play the victim card, and we need to.
Well, he can do that through unity,
and that's where I was going to go, and that's where they're going to get to that unity. I think you're probably right, and sadly, I think you might be right that image, which you got to give him credit for having the political mind to take that breath and go, hey, I gotta get this great photo op, and look, as I said to my daughter. Your grandchildren will see that picture because that is history.
Yeah. Because, you know, because I heard I could hear the audio. I think one of the shoes came off or something. So I want my shoe or something. Normally, you know, you jump on a president when something happens and you can't even see the president. He managed to get his hand up there, right? And you're right. It is the iconic photo of a decade.
No, yes. You could see him. You could see him. You could see the thought process going as I watch it. I watched the thought process go. He gathered himself, and then he's like, "I got to fight through this." And that's when he did the whole fight thing. And yeah. You said, "I go look. The guy, he's a political animal. I mean, he gets what the yeah. gravity of the moment and how to yes. best use that. You got to give him credit for that."
Yes, he got it. It's like Reagan. You know, Reagan gets shot. They push him into the car. He gets to the hospital, and And this is the famous line. The first thing you heard, "Are you a Democrat or a Republican?" He asks the guy at the emergency room. You know, I mean, it's just okay.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Last line of question I got for you: the DNC is going to be about a month after. There seems to be some divided message. Any thoughts on where that's going to take us?
I think Biden is in this. I know there are, you know, many who want to replace him. I said last time we talked, you and I talked, you know, by the time your show was over with, they had to make a decision. Well, your show ended that night. Here we are on, you know, another day and night. So, I believe that as this week progresses with the Republican National Convention, Biden's not going to get out. And so therefore, the Democrats are going to have a unity day. Speaking of unifying, they're going to have a unity day, stop the talk and go after it, because I could be wrong. I just don't think he's going to get out.
Yeah, I don't think so either, especially now. I just don't see how he can. But we'll see. I still think it's time to pass the torch. But I think he will. I think he believes he's the best candidate to take on Trump in November. Right. We'll see what happens. Yep. But Bob, as always, appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Good stuff. Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
This is the Shaw, WAUK. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Severe thunderstorm watch for Milwaukee and Waukesha. Tornado watch Kenosha Racine. Scattered showers and thunderstorms tonight. Some could be severe with large hail and damaging wind gusts. Heavy rainfall a concern as well. Warm and muggy with lows near 70. Currently at 75 degrees.
As a network, we're called Civic Media because a big part of it is we want to start modeling how civic discourse really should happen and being respectful of each other's opinions, even if you disagree, you know, like they should be given a platform.
If Rocker and I can get along, right. We can all get along.
I know,
along.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. Rocker?
Yeah, that's right, Jimmy.
Well, you do have a wall in between the two of you, so
glass.
It's like the
it's only glass. It's only
tear down the walls. Listen to Max Inc. Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media radio network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I came across a story from Wisconsin that piqued my interest. As a Dane County judge, a guy named Jacob Frost has issued a decision that 13 years after Scott Walker's Act 10 went into law, is now saying, well, we're going to strike part of it down. And that's the part that basically created the division of, yeah, we're going to screw over this set of public sector workers, but, you know, police and fire, they're going to be okay. And what they're saying is, you know, it lacks a rational basis to have that kind of division between the general public sector workers and public safety employees. So we'll see where this goes. But Act 10 was horrible, not just for Wisconsin, but really across the country was the beginning of another assault on workers. And here to share some thoughts on this decision, I've asked our good friend Michael Sonato to come talk with us. Michael's a labor reporter over at The Guardian US. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on again.
So what do you make of this? I mean, you know, 13 years after the fact, we're now going to say part of it. You're going to strike part of it down. And then how do you make any of those people who have been harmed by this, how do you make them whole or assign any I don't know. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are it's, you know, a bit of good news in times, especially when we're dealing with courts where, you know, the courts in the U.S. here are very anti-worker. And, you know, not just in Wisconsin, but, you know, across the country, public sector workers especially have been facing union busting at the behest of Republicans. Like, you know, where I am in Florida, a right to work wasn't enough. DeSantis passed the ridiculous law where workers have to basically organize and show that they have a majority support every single year, or else their union gets thrown out, or they have to hold another election.
Well, that came out of this Act 10 as well. I mean, this was part of what Scott Walker. I mean, to be honest, you know, this was the beginning. This was the playbook that Republican governors and legislatures across the country have picked up and moved forward on. And I remember, you know, we were there in 2011 when the uprising of, you know, 100,000 plus people were in that Capitol. We were sleeping on the floor of that Capitol. And I remember coming back to Pennsylvania and telling, you know, one of the prominent labor leaders here, get ready, because this is, they're packaging this to come across the country. And, well, that guy told me, don't worry about it. We're not Wisconsin. And this stuff spread like wildfire.
Yeah, and you know, a few years later, the Janus decision, you know, obviously that didn't have the impact I think anti-union forces were hoping for, but that kind of really emboldened this, like you said, was kind of the starting point, and it still serves as a playbook for you know, Republicans to pass anti-union laws that undermine and dispel you know, public sector workers, which you know, here in the U.S. that's you know, the unionization density is primarily public sector workers, and it's why those you know, jobs are, you know, good paying jobs. It's why they're highly coveted. But in places where they've gotten rid of that, it's kind of, you know, declined. It's not the same thing, you know, without a union. So.
Yeah, what I find interesting is, you know, you look at this Act 10, which is what we call it all the time. It's, oh, it's Act 10. What the official name is the Wisconsin Budget Repair Bill. And basically what they're telling us is the only way that they could balance their budget is to screw over the workers who work for the state. And it's what they did. I mean, they increased their contributions to their pensions, to their health care. They limited how much of a raise they could get. They really stuck it to public sector workers, limited their collective bargaining rights, ended automatic dues deductions. I mean, and then the annual recertifications, it was so much. And you could argue, well, it helped balance the budget. Yeah, by running a lot of good people out of the state.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were, you know, campaigns, you know, there were a group of nurses, hundreds of nurses at the University of Wisconsin Health System that tried to organize in spite of Act 10. And their employer kept saying, no, Act 10 is the law. We're not going to let you do anything. We're not going to bargain with you. And that was during the COVID-19 pandemic. So it is really just giving employers an excuse to not listen to their workers and exploit them and, you know, treat them as expendable. So this had far reaching implications in Wisconsin, you know, for workers, and, you know, emboldened, you know, anti-union forces, you know, not only in Wisconsin. I'm sure it undermined organizing efforts, not only in the public sector, but the private sector as well in Wisconsin. It's hard to quantify how much things like that impact worker organizing. And we talk about declining union density and things, but, you know, these pieces contributed to it. Maybe not immediately, but, you know, a few years down the line with laws on the books like this, it has an effect.
I mean, I have people ask me why, you know, why doesn't labor support Republicans, and why is it such a big deal that Sean O'Brien's going to speak before the RNC, and why am I so opposed to it? I go, look, Republicans have shown us who they are time and time and time again. This Scott Walker thing is a perfect example of that. They limited collective bargaining rights. They did all of these horrible things to public sector workers. Also pushed the no rights at work thing. 2015, they passed a right to work law. They ended you know, project labor agreements and the baby bacons, the prevailing wage act stuff. They did all of this stuff to crush wages and to hurt working people. So you go, gee, what could I possibly be in favor of?
Yeah, absolutely. And they carved out firefighters and police unions, so they weren't impacted, which kind of you know, just takes the mask off on, you know, what they are trying to claim that it was doing. So, you know, the groups that they support, you know, they wrote out of the bills, and they do that in states all over the place where, you know, police unions are exempted from laws like this. They were here in Florida. You know, that has, I think a bigger conversation on, like, where police unions stand in the AFL-CIO and the labor movement as a whole when they are silent or, you know, condone those types of, you know, anti-union policies being implemented.
I got to tell you, though, it was amazing when I was there in 2011, and the firefighters walked in with the bagpipes. It was really, it was a moment. And Malin Mitchell was the head of the firefighters union in Wisconsin at the time. And I remember, and he ended up running for governor and lieutenant governor and a couple other things. But I remember that moment of solidarity with the firefighters and them coming in. And that was a pretty impressive moment that I remember. I want to move on real quick because some interesting news coming out of California. Potentially 14,000 workers at Disney? At the Disneyland, or is it Disneyland or World?
Disneyland. Disney World's in Florida.
There we go. So Disneyland. Why?
So Disneyland workers, their contract expired last month. And in the midst of negotiations, hundreds of workers were reprimanded for wearing union buttons. Disney said it's against policy. Take them off. They filed unfair labor practices. And so this is an unfair labor practice strike. The vote's next week. The results should be out by the 20th. If they do go out on strike, it's going to be 14,000 cast members at Disney, the largest strike so far of this year. I think there was a hospital system with a few thousand workers earlier this year that went on strike. So it definitely would be big for these workers. And a big sticking point is wages. Their last contract was $18 an hour, which is lower than the living wage in Anaheim. The minimum wage, a law was passed that has the minimum wage of $19.90 an hour. And Disney tried to fight that. They lost. They tried to bring that to the state Supreme Court to challenge that rule because they didn't even want to pay that. And now they're using that rule to say, oh, look, the contract, we're improving wages. Well, they already had to. So it's an expensive place to live, expensive, the just rent in that area is astronomical. Many workers, have to live far away and commute just to be able to live. They're living with roommates. I spoke with a cashier who was there, who's been there for over 30 years. And she said, when she first started, I could get a 2-bedroom apartment with no problem on the pay they pay you. And today, that's impossible. And I think that's, everyone thinks because Disney's so popular and, they do so well that the workers are getting treated right when that's not the case. They've been falling behind in contracts and contracts and contracts over the years. And, the workers are standing up and saying enough's enough.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because I just had this conversation today about inflation and, how upset this person was. And I said, look, the sad reality is wages haven't kept up. If we're the 1970s, like my grandparents, who were both in unions at the time and their union contracts had automatic cost of living adjustments in those contracts, whereas inflation went up, their wages went up. So their standard of living didn't go down. If we had stronger union density, inflation wouldn't be as big of a deal. So when I hear that you've got these unionized workers who've been working in this job for years and their wages haven't just been keeping up, it's not just them. It's all across the country. And it's one of these things that I'm hoping at some point we actually start making a point out of and complaining a little bit more about or going on strike about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important not just for these workers at Disneyland, but they'll set the precedent for other theme parks and for, Disney World workers here in Florida. In Florida, because it's a right to work state, the union strength isn't as great as in California. They do have a no strike clause in their contract here. These workers win at Disneyland will, embolden and set the standard for what Disney World workers and Universal and Legoland and all those places will look forward to. But right now these workers are, working minimum wage and being exploited based on the fact that it is an appealing place to work because, people are fans of Disney. People like the atmosphere. So, you know, people take, you know, these companies tend to take advantage of that fact.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we'll see how this plays out. Also, I wanted to get your thoughts on the elections coming up. And you just put out a story the other day about how Unite Here, the hospitality union is ramping up their political action and getting out there and getting their members to understand how important the election is, as all the unions are doing, because you know the power of the unions, the power of people, and the power of getting them to vote maybe on things that would make their lives better. Walk me through what you're seeing there at Unite Here.
So Unite Here elected their first female president, Gwen Mills, a few weeks ago. She was the one who kind of developed their 2020 grassroots door knocking strategy. And, you know, it was a big deal. It was a big success. They focused on a lot of the swing states that were pivotal in Biden's victory. And, by the evidence we have now, their efforts are going to be just as important this year, especially because, Biden has portrayed himself as so pro-labor, and that's such a staunch a contradiction to the Trump administration. People are talking about Project 2025 now. They want to get rid of things like overtime, the very anti-union. Under the Trump administration, they're very, the NLRB was not, a lot of the rules and policies they were implementing were very anti-worker. It was just the industry wish list of what they wanted was getting kind of passed. And it was really putting the labor movement under the defense. In the past few years, it's kind of turned around. So, it poses a big question, and it hasn't really been focused on. I think that's what one of Biden's greatest strengths in this election cycle is, focusing on that support for the labor movement, for workers, the big gains and the victories that have been afforded to workers, like the overtime rule recently.
Yeah. And the heat regulation that they just came out with. If you're a working person, if you punch a clock for a living, if you got a union card in your wallet, there's no choice in this election. Biden is the guy because he's been on the right side of every issue. Whereas, Donald Trump's running on a platform of we're going to fire all the federal workers and we're going to make patronage great again. I'm struggling, man. I'm struggling to see it. But look, as we looked at Wisconsin 13 years ago and all the stuff that they got away with and did, I'm just not surprised. But Michael, as always, I appreciate the thoughts, the time. Keep up the great work that you do over there at The Guardian. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Rick.
Good stuff. Michael Sonato, labor reporter there at The Guardian US. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the day that labor leader Eugene V. Debs was arrested for supporting the strike of Pullman Palace Car Company workers. In May, the workers who made the popular train sleeping cars had walked off the job. George Pullman had slashed the workers' wages but kept the rents in his company town steady. The striking workers called on Eugene Debs to support their strike. Debs had made a name for himself in the labor movement by successfully founding the American Railway Union. The union joined together railroad workers in an unprecedented force of solidarity across job types. In June, the union voted to boycott Pullman in support of the train car makers. As rail traffic ground to a halt, the federal government moved in to end the strike. Federal troops were called out. A federal court issued an injunction against Debs and the boycott.
The basis for Deb's arrest was the claim that the boycott interfered with the delivery of the U.S. mail by the trains. Debs served a 6-month jail sentence in Woodstock, Illinois. His case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which decided in favor of the injunction. When Debs was released from prison, he delivered a speech he called Liberty. In it, he declared, quote, "The people have seen the money power practicing at every art of duplicity, growing more arrogant and despotic as it robbed one and crushed another, building its fortification of the bones of its victims and its palaces out of the profits of its piracies." The Pullman strike and the American Railway Union were crushed, and injunctions became a powerful tool against the labor movement.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So I got to tell you, you know, my mind is stuck in Wisconsin in 2011. We were sleeping on the floor of the Capitol in February. Cold. I remember very cold. And I'll tell you, it was an amazing moment of activism and an amazing moment of community, and people who wanted to fight for a better life because they understood what Scott Walker was doing at the time. And for those who don't remember, Walker pushed this idea, the Budget Repair Bill Act 10, which was all about going after the state workers. It was all about, you know, limiting their ability to collectively bargain. It was all about, you know, making it as hard as possible for the unions to be able to represent, for members, for people to join. They even went as the petty stuff of, we're not going to collect the union dues out of your paycheck and give it to the union. The dues checkoff, we're not going to allow that anymore. And it's literally a code. In a computer costs nothing to do. In fact, you know, when they tried to do it here in Pennsylvania, they were trying, you know, the labor folks at the time were going, well, tell us how much it cost. We'll pay you for it. And they couldn't tell how little it cost. But understand what the point of that all was. It was to limit the ability of workers to fight for better wages, hours, conditions. It was to limit their ability to be a political force. This really was the beginning of the most recent attack. You go back to Reagan and the firing of the Patco workers, the shot heard across the boardroom. This was the most recent iteration of that, where the moneyed interests, and I remember, you know, the billionaire Diane Hendricks, you know, who famously got caught on tape, you know, in one of the most bizarre kind of almost sexual way of going, when do we get right to work? Because, you know, a billionaire concerned that her workers were going to make $1 an hour more. And this is what it was about. It was about power. It was about ensuring that workers didn't have the ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and also to punish. And, you know, I found it interesting at the time that they were going through all this, and everyone knew it was highly, highly partisan, highly divisive. In fact, something they tried to sneak through like thieves in the night, had it not been for a bunch of college students who actually read the bill and understood that it was going to affect them in enormous ways, because it also went and slashed funding for education, which screwed up their education system. So all of the themes that we've been talking about, you know, for the last, you know, 19 years doing this show, you know, Walker put together in one playbook. You go after education, you go after public sector workers, you go after union workers, because eventually they went after prevailing wage laws. Eventually they passed the whole right to work package that comes along, attacked unemployment insurance, attacked workers' comp, all of this stuff to, well, diminish a worker's ability to make lives better. And you fast forward to now, where we've got this inflation that we've lived through the last couple of years, where had you a stronger labor movement, you would have been able to mitigate some of the pain by increasing wages, by saying, look, you know, inflation's going up, wages should go up to meet it so our standard of living doesn't fall. Because we don't ever say we, during hard times, we should be taxing the very wealthy. You never hear Republicans talk about that. So I find it interesting that, you know, we're kind of in this moment again, where it's a which side are you on kind of moment. Are you on the side of working people? Are you a working person yourself? And how these reforms that Republicans keep throwing at us, how they affect our lives, how they harm our lives. You know, and as I said a moment ago, you know, I've had people over the years say, well, why don't you, you know, support Republican politicians? Because, you know, they believe in paying their, you know, budget, balanced budgets, and they believe in America. And I'm going, you know, there are some things that I agree with what they say. Like, I think you do have to pay your bills. I'm right there with you. But they don't ever do it. Oddly enough, when Republicans are in office, they run up higher deficits, more debt. They're worse at it. They're worse at the economy in every metrics possible, except enriching the very wealthy. That they do masterfully. You know, so for me, it's which side am I on? I'm on the side of working people. I'm on the side of when I get my paycheck, is it enough to cover the roof over our head, the clothes on my kids' back, the food on the dinner table? And the sad reality for too many, it's getting harder and harder. So when you got someone like Joe Biden who's saying, look, we want you to be able to collectively bargain, fight for those better wages, hours, conditions, fight for that wealth that your labor creates, I'm on Team Biden. But I look at my Republican friends. And look, I wish I understood a working person voting against their own economic interest. I wish I got it. And I've had people say, well, you know, it's because of guns, it's because of religion, it's because, you know, whatever, you know, throw the whatever in there. At the end of the day, it's about putting food on your table and keeping a roof over your head. All that other stuff comes from the economic power that you get from having decent wages, hours, conditions. So I just thought it was interesting that, you know, here we are all these years later. This is still something that is there. Now, you know, I remember coming back from Wisconsin because we spent 2 weeks there right at the beginning of the uprising. We were the first radio program to broadcast from within the Capitol. We were in Brett Halsey's office. He was a state representative at the time. And, you know, we got the show out and, you know, we got to interview tons of people. And I remember, you know, coming back going, this is much bigger than just Wisconsin. You look at the complexity of the legislation and all of the targets that they're going after. And it's all of the worker organizations. It's all of the things that working people need, like education and healthcare and all of this stuff. Under the guise of, you know, we need to cut the budget. And what does that mean? That means cutting things for working people. That means cutting the things that you and me and our neighbors need. That's the repair. We got to fix things the way they used to be, which is desperate workers working in deplorable conditions, which, trust me, we're moving back towards quickly. But I remember coming back from Wisconsin, coming back to Pennsylvania and talking to the guy who was the head of the AFL here at the time. And I said, you know, this is big stuff. We should start organizing around the idea that this stuff is coming. And he looked at me and said, you know, that's Wisconsin. Couldn't happen here. And within a year, all of that legislation had made its way. Because understand, we then found out, you know, everyone started to learn who ALEC was, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and how a lot of this stuff was model legislation from them and other right-wing think tanks, and how the game plan here was much larger. The game plan was much better funded than anyone knew in February of 2011. We learned quickly. But it was much larger and much better coordinated. The one thing that the right does, the one thing that the moneyed interest does, when they know there's something they want, you know, your health care, your retirement, your wage increases, you know, any of that stuff, they absolutely, positively, without question, know how to get it. And they come up with cute little euphemistic name groups who, you know, the Employment Rights Center and all these national, the right to work people. They don't care about you. What they care about is more for their funders, more for the wealthy, and less for you. So this election, it's a big deal. You got one guy who's been, he walked a picket line. He found Obama's comfortable shoes, hit a picket line. You got another guy, he's running on, I'm going to fire everybody. Bizarre times. Bizarre times. Miss any part of this portion of the program? Podcast. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
To the Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to The Shaw. WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.